been under a cloud all my life. I'm sort of like living in Juneau. It rains on you all the time. You don't even notice it.
Congressman Don Young speaks out about the ethics investigation. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, March 28th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, researchers dig into a new permafrost tunnel near Fairbanks.
And really what we see in the walls here is a lot of climate records.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Congressman Don Young says he's not worried about an investigation into whether he violated ethics rules. The House Ethics Committee announced this month that they're looking into whether the congressman misused campaign funds, failed to report gifts, and lied to federal officials. During a visit to Juneau, Young told reporters that he is cooperating with the investigation. He also accused the committee of playing politics in targeting him alongside New Jersey Democrat Rob Andrews.
You know, reality is that I truly believe that they had to have a Republican as well as a Democrat. As you know, Andrews is under the scrutiny, too. And we'll see what happens. I'm confident where I am, always have been. If I wasn't that confident, I couldn't continue to run and look the Alaskans in the eye.
Young had previously been under investigation by the FBI for the same charges.
I've been under a cloud all my life. I'm sort of like living in Juneau. It rains on you all the time. You don't even notice it.
The FBI concluded that there was not enough evidence to convict him beyond reasonable doubt. In a 2010 memo, the FBI said they had instead forwarded a letter outlining certain actions taken by Congressman Young and will leave punishment to the discretion of the Ethics Committee. A panel of experts met last night at the University of Alaska Justice Center to discuss tribal courts in Alaska. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes was there and has the story.
Assistant Professor Kevin Illingworth heads the Tribal Management Program for the University of Alaska Interior Aleutians campus. He says tribal nations predating the United States gave up lands and resources, but extensive federal and state laws and court rulings have established they did not give up their inherent sovereignty.
Inherent authority essentially means that tribes have all the sovereign authority that they have ever had, unless that was specifically taken away by the United States Congress.
Illingworth says tribal judicial systems have existed since time immemorial and continue to serve a useful purpose. For instance, he says tribal courts are able to help families situated far from the state's Office of Children's Services, or OCS, which maintains offices in urban and hub communities.
Kids have to fall a long ways to get caught by that OCS safety net. Tribal sovereignty and the tribe is there right away to make sure that people can get help when they need it, that they don't have to wait, that they don't have to call somebody outside of the community, that people can be safe in their own communities. To me, that's what tribal sovereignty is about. It really is about taking care of your own community, making sure that people are safe, making sure that it's a good place to live.
According to a 2011 survey by the Alaska Legal Services Corporation, there are at least 78 tribal courts in the state. They hear cases ranging from animal control and juvenile delinquency to domestic violence protection. Tribal government specialist Lisa Yeager with the Tanana Chiefs Conference says in the years since Congress adopted the Indian Child Welfare Act of 1978, tribal courts just in interior Alaska have prosecuted an estimated 3,000 cases, many of them adoptions and child custody cases.
We have 37 tribal courts. We have 37 tribes. They are not all active at the same time. We have some tribes right now that don't have any active cases. We have other tribes that will have 100 cases right now that are active in their tribal court.
In recent weeks, tribes have criticized an amendment to the Violence Against Women Act that specifically limits Alaska Native tribal sovereignty. The law recognizes the authority of Native American tribes to prosecute offenders in cases involving non-natives and tribal members. When sponsor U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska introduced the amendment in February, she said it clarifies that those provisions only apply to Alaska's one reservation, Metlakatla, because other Alaska tribes are landless. But staff attorney Natalie Landreth with the Native American Rights Fund says case law from the 1990s makes it clear tribal authority is not tied to land status.
We are way behind the lower 48. This law is already established. It's already established that you don't need Indian country to have jurisdiction over civil matters, especially things like children's cases. It's already established that the core of your jurisdiction is over your tribal members. It's already established that not everybody in the case involved needs to be a member of the same tribe. Whoever the impacted person was has to be either a member of the tribe or eligible for membership. These are very well-established rules, and we're simply applying them within Alaska.
Landreth says tribal courts are critically important in protecting the vulnerable in 140 communities in rural Alaska without any law enforcement. Before it was enacted, senators criticized the Violence Against Women Act over concerns non-natives wouldn't receive fair treatment in tribal courts. Washington Senator Maria Cantwell responded, "The act restates existing requirements that tribal courts protect civil rights." Under a Rural Alaska Public Safety Initiative proposed by Murkowski, the state would individually review tribal court procedures and could approve courts to try cases of domestic violence among their own tribal members and with the consent of the offender, but excluding non-natives and offenders from other tribes. Tribal leaders and state officials are reviewing the proposal. Murkowski was not available for comment on this story. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jocelyn Estes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a day for honoring Vietnam veterans and their families in Alaska.
We have a lot of families in Alaska today that lost a son or daughter or a grandson or an uncle. And so this is a day for us to remember them.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
Bagpipes led Choose Respect marchers in Anchorage today. The annual event is aimed at heightening awareness of Alaska's blight of sexual assault while gathering support for the state administration's campaign against domestic violence. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer followed the march.
The march kicked off at noon. Alaska Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell, Senator Lisa Murkowski, and other state and city notables fronted the march, all helping to hold a Choose Respect banner the three blocks to the city's town square. They were joined by church and civic groups and city workers spending their lunch break for a cause. The north wind was biting, the temperatures low, and the mood somber in light of the recent death of a Hooper Bay woman at the hands of an abuser. Treadwell told rallygoers at the finish of the march that Alaska's epidemic of domestic violence and sexual assault will end when the silence protecting abuse ends.
And I want to live in a generation where we don't hide domestic violence, sexual assault, these issues in the family, in our families, in our homes any longer.
Senator Murkowski added her remarks shortly afterwards. Before taking the podium, Murkowski had been approached by Alaska Native activist Deesa Jacobson, who protested that funds spent on the rally would have better been spent on rural village protection. Murkowski alluded to the incident from the podium, saying that she was ashamed that Alaska leads the nation in violence against women.
I am ashamed that we are the rape capital of the nation. Everything that we are doing is reactive. It's after the fact. It's after these women and these children have been violated. It's after their lives have been ruined.
Despite the frigid cold, marchers waved colorful signs. The sun came out and free coffee and sandwiches were offered. But the crowd was reminded of the rally's grim purpose when a young Juneau woman, introduced only by her first name, Connie, gave a firsthand account of her efforts to escape an abusive marriage.
For me, in my situation, an inquisitive person told me, "That's not normal in a marriage." That statement started me on a path towards ending my rationalizations. These were rationalizations that said for over 10 years, he didn't really mean to say that to me. He'll get better, and if I just do more of anything, if I just cook more, if I just work harder, things will change. I told myself to cope.
Treadwell told the group that choosing respect means getting involved, and he asked the crowd to make a pledge.
Repeat after me, I pledge never to commit.
I pledge never to commit.
Condone or remain silent.
About violence against women.
Men.
Men.
Children.
Children.
The elderly.
And the vulnerable.
So help us God. Thank you very, very much.
I'm Ellen Lockyer.
In the early 1960s, engineers dug a tunnel into permafrost roughly 16 miles north of Fairbanks. They were testing underground excavation methods. The U.S. Bureau of Mines also used part of the original tunnel to test mining techniques in permafrost. On March 15th, personnel with the Army Corps of Engineers Cold Climate Research and Engineering Laboratory, or CRIL, wrapped up a month's worth of digging as part of a project to build a new tunnel that will eventually join the older one. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, it's part of an effort to expand scientific research and public outreach.
Roughly 50 feet underground, an enormous yellow excavator fitted with a special digging apparatus turns from left to right slowly, scraping at a wall of light brown frozen earth. Chunks of frozen dirt flake off and pile up on the floor. When pieces of the permafrost are moved around, they sound like glass. Kevin Biela mans the excavator. He's a research civil engineer with CREL. He studies the impact of permafrost on engineering projects in places like Fairbanks. He's doing some of that research as he digs.
So every time that we do a cycle, we then survey the face, look for bones, look at the paleosols, see if we need to take any samples for carbon dating. And so we don't want to go too fast. We never want to go too fast, although it would be great to get the project done, but at the same time, we want to do science, too.
This particular project will eventually connect to an older tunnel, which has been used for research for 50 years.
Well, there's a lot of great research that was done in the old tunnel, and we wanted to expand upon that. Not that everything has been done in the old tunnel, but having a whole new exposure and parallel to it can expand the story. And really what we see in the walls here is a lot of climate records.
Those climate records look like thick, dark stripes in the tunnel walls. These are all old soil layers that indicate when the climate was warmer and wetter, anywhere between 7 and 30,000 years ago. They can explain what might happen as climate changes in the future. Biela says the new tunnel will also be used as a geophysical test bed.
So we actually know where all the ice is on a three-dimensional scale. And when we apply geophysics to it, we'll be able to test different geophysical techniques that are looking for ground ice. So there's a couple different reasons, but in the end, we'll probably have a whole overarching group of people that will come in here from paleoscientists, geologists, microbiologists, researchers, even extraterrestrial. We've had NASA projects in the old tunnel.
But to connect the old tunnel with this newer one, Biela and his colleagues will have to dig about 1,000 feet into a hillside. And they have to find a way to do it without melting any permafrost.
It is challenging. The one thing that the original tunnel was built with all equipment that was electrically powered. So they had very little heat generation. We're obviously dealing with this excavator, diesel-powered excavator that does have a lot of heat generation. So in addition to getting the diesel fumes out of it for the operator, we need to keep the temperature down. And so we are having to blow in copious amounts of cold air, and the colder the better.
The crew can only dig in the winter, and because it's so slow going, they can only dig about 100 feet per year. It could take up to a decade to complete the project, and funding isn't available on a regular basis, which also slows progress.
Well, this is internally funded through CREL. We didn't put out any, we didn't take any congressional appropriation for this or anything like that. It's more driven from internally that we see that there's a great benefit to expanding the facility.
In addition to expanding the tunnel, CREL has laid the foundation and purchased logs to build a new visitor center. It'll replace a small trailer that currently houses the office for the permafrost tunnel. The Army Corps is looking to improve an education and outreach program associated with the tunnel and ongoing research at the site. For KUAC News, I'm Emily Schwing in Fairbanks.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority was created by the Alaska State Legislature to develop, stimulate, and advance the economic welfare of the state and further the development of public transportation systems. The authority has completed required environmental work to date, and the Federal Highway Administration has given its approval needed to move forward. There's more information at KinnickArmBridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
Tomorrow's Friday, and on Fridays, on Alaska's Capitol Hill, many female legislators are wearing kusbucks, the traditional and comfortable Eskimo garment not often seen in boardrooms. It's also being adopted by some men in the Capitol. Lisa Fu has this report on Kusbuck Friday.
On this particular Friday, Senate Secretary Liz Clark's kusbuck is getting a lot of attention.
Somebody told me the fabric is called Fairy Frost. So it's sort of a, I would call it a turquoise blue, and it's got the Fairy Frost purple trim with some red rickrack over top. It also has the multicolored cat heads lining the hood and the pocket. It's more of a dress length with the ruffle. It feels like a muumuu to wear, so it couldn't be more comfortable.
Clark owns 5 kusbucks. She and other legislative staff easily joined what's become a tradition among legislators who started wearing kusbucks to work on Friday about a decade ago. Anchorage Senator Liesl McGuire credits the idea to former Representative Mary Kapsner, an Alaska native from Bethel.
Back when she was in the House of Representatives serving, she had an aide named Katie Rell, and they started wearing kusbucks every Friday.
When Rell passed away from an illness, Kapsner and other women in the House of Representatives continued wearing kusbucks to honor her legacy. Kusbuck Friday soon spread to the Senate, where now it's part of the Friday uniform for the pages. The Senate secretaries, the sergeant-at-arms, and her assistant also take part in the tradition. 3 of these kusbuck-clad individuals on the Senate floor are men. Senator McGuire would like to see even more males embrace Kusbuck Friday.
Part of what we are trying to do is get more masculine fabrics introduced. Our assistant sergeant-at-arms, Andy Higgins, has come out with some really bold, a black one with some gold piping. And so it would be nice to get the Senate president and the majority leader wearing a kusbuck as well.
Eagle River Senator Anna Fairclough served with Mary Kapsner. Most Fridays, Fairclough can be seen wearing a kusbuck. While she enjoys the functional purposes of the garment, like the big pockets, Fairclough says Kusbuck Friday means something more.
It's a solidarity, per se, with the women around Alaska that we know where our roots are at. We know that there are traditional values in all cultures across Alaska that need to be respected, and it's our way of embracing that.
While a kusbuck is a traditional Alaska Native garment, Senator McGuire notes most of those wearing kusbucks on Friday in the Capitol building are not Native.
Non-Native Alaskans take pride in celebrating the Alaska Native heritage. And I think that's something that I have really enjoyed seeing grow in this building in my 13 years here. It's something that I would not say was immediately a part of the culture, but it's certainly become a part of it.
Wrangell Representative Peggy Wilson owns 4 cuspucks.
I love wearing it because it's so much more comfortable than anything else I wear.
Freshman Representative Harriet Drummond of Anchorage borrowed a cuspuck from a friend for Cuspuck Fridays. She says it fits her normal outside the Capitol style.
I like wearing hoodies in my off hours, and this is an appropriate type of hoodie to wear to work.
In the usual sea of dark suits and stiff collars in a state capitol, Cuspuck Friday adds a touch of fun, color, and comfort to the work week. It's also a symbol of Alaska's diversity of cultures and people. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Governor Sean Parnell has signed legislation designating tomorrow, March 29th, as Vietnam Veterans Day in honor of those who served more than 40 years ago in that conflict. Anchorage resident Rick Davich is the national chairman for government affairs for Vietnam Veterans in America. He is a veteran of the U.S. Army. He went to Vietnam in 1965 as a 19-year-old medic. He says many Vietnam veterans did well after the war, at least at first.
The majority of Vietnam veterans, when they came home, one of the things that we know now, which is an interesting story, is they put all that stuff behind them. They got into families, they got into jobs, they got into careers, and they began to adjust, reassimilate. What's happening, which is fascinating, is many of Vietnam veterans are now retiring, facing divorce, and suddenly we have this significant spike in post-traumatic stress because the post-traumatic stress they brought home with them from Vietnam was suppressed and sort of pushed back in their brain and not dealt with. And then suddenly, because their world has changed, it percolates up and causes significant emotional trauma. And unfortunately, we've seen a lot of suicide as a result. So that's an interesting thing that we're finding.
How do the services offered to veterans compare in Alaska to the rest of the country? Is this a good place to be a veteran?
Alaska is a very good place to be. I've been working, as I said, on veterans issues for 2 decades. We're very blessed with a congressional delegation, even though they're split in party, that is 100% behind veterans and veterans' needs and veterans' issues. Lisa Murkowski, Mark Begich, and Don Young, I know them personally, I've known them for many, many years. When I'm back there, we always meet and we talk about what's going on. Lisa in particular lately has been really pushing the rural health care for veterans and passed a law and has made significant advantage. One of the great things about Susan Yeager, our new VA director for health care in Alaska, she put that program together over 2 years, so she knows rural Alaska. We had the secretary up here last year, and the secretary said, you know, I get it. This is not rural. This is remote. And we've been telling people this for some time. So we're in a very good place. Now, that doesn't mean it's perfect. We have a lot of needs up here. But our veteran service officers who work for veterans organizations are out, strongly supported by the state of Alaska. We have an extraordinary state director in Verde Bowen who works for the state. It's clearly the best we've had since the inception of the position. Does a wonderful job, and as you see, the legislature continues to be very focused on meeting the needs of veterans. And as we often say, as I had one state senator some years ago say to me, well, you know, you guys are just another welfare group. And I said, excuse me, Senator, these are services that were earned by service and sacrifice. These are not services that are given due to our income status.
Alaska has the highest number of veterans in the country, and I believe that's particularly true of Vietnam vets.
That's very true of Vietnam vets.
Why is that? Why do you think that is, that there's so many Vietnam veterans here?
One of the interesting things about Vietnam veterans, because of what happened to us when we came home, is we just want to isolate, which is a real struggle for us that deal with veteran services. And you go to a village, you go to a rural part of Alaska, and there's some guy living in a boat that hasn't been in the water for 20 years, and he hasn't been out of there, and he has a wheelchair, and he can't move around. And we find these guys all the time, and they've just decided to go out and isolate. They simply want to separate themselves from their community, from their culture, from where they grew up. The great tragedy is that America has learned as a result of the Vietnam veteran experience that when we come home from war, It's the embrace of our nation. It's the embrace of our community. It's the embrace of our families that really begins the healing. That's where the healing begins. We lie to ourselves a lot. We tell ourselves lots of stories about what we did and what we had to do to survive and carry out our mission. But when you get on that plane and you're coming home, you begin to think about that. And if the country and the community and the families and the churches, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and the service organizations do not embrace these guys and these gals, it's going to be hard. And that's what happened to us. And we, our motto as an organization is never again will one generation of veterans abandon another. And we do that every day. And that's why we serve every veteran, not just Vietnam veterans.
What does it mean to you that tomorrow will be the first day designated by our governor to honor not just vets generally, but Vietnam vets in particular?
Well, this is a piece of legislation that I've been working on for 3 years. I work on lots of bills in Juneau. But I was delighted. We had a number of Vietnam veterans go down to Juneau for the ceremony. I couldn't go down because I was tied up. So we are one of, I think now, 20-some states that have made March 29th forever Vietnam Veterans Day. We have legislation in Congress. We expect the president to announce an executive order tomorrow making March 29th Vietnam Veterans Day. But we have a bill in Congress, hopefully will pass during this Congress, if they do anything, that will make nationally March 29th Vietnam Veterans Day forever. And what the purpose of this is not just to remember Vietnam veterans, although obviously this is an important part. We have a lot of families in Alaska today that lost a son or daughter or a grandson or an uncle. And so this is a day for us to remember them.
Rick Davidge is the National Chairman for Government Affairs for Vietnam Veterans in America. A longer version of this interview can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org, along with a list of Alaskans who died in Vietnam. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Jacqueline Estes and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, and Lisa Fu in Juneau. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez also reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering that public transportation can benefit their businesses and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, and social opportunities. There's more information at alaskamobility.org. This message sponsored by the nonprofit organizations Alaska Mobility Coalition and the American Public Transportation Association. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The 2013 Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference is May 2nd and 3rd at the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage. This annual conference offers participants an unmatched opportunity to network with national industry experts and learn the latest on policies, programs, and projects in the clean energy industry. Take advantage of the early bird registration before March 29th. There's more information online at bceaconference.com or 929-7770. This message sponsored by REAP.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.